G'day friends, and welcome to Happy Days. This is your pal Jesse on the mic, thanking each and every single one of you for taking the time to listen to my little podcast here on the Freak Productions website. Go to www.freekproductions.com and support the cause that is my creative journey, including my latest release, my debut children's book, Fly Bat Fly, beautifully illustrated by Nikki Kerwick. This is a great book that explores the wonderful world of bats in all its cuteness and educates young minds that bats aren't as terrifying and scary as they initially look. As we all know, they're cute and lovable. But this is a great little introduction to the world of bats. It's by no means an accurate educational tool or anything. It's just merely just a fun read between adult and child to expand young minds and enjoy something cute. But anyway, let's get on with the show. Speaking of writers, this week's episode, I speak to a good friend, musician also turned writer extraordinaire, Sam Phillips. The author of countless horror and sci-fi books, he's enjoyed creative life as both a self-published author, but also as a published author. So we talk about the ins and outs whilst enduring quite a few technical difficulties in this episode, which I profusely offer my apologies for. Unfortunately, when you record a podcast, it's a roll of the dice. Sometimes you get a great connection, sometimes you get a not so bad connection, other times you just fight the technological gremlins that just chew into your connection for whatever reason, and it just makes life more interesting. So look, we have an episode for you. It ain't perfect, but it's real. It's a great conversation. Sam is a great guy. He's the drummer of Decryptus and Chaosphere. And, not only is he a fellow metalhead, but he's also just a very switched on individual with quite a few interesting insights to offer. So this is a great episode for you creative types out there looking to get into writing and want to learn something about getting into being a published author. Sam offers, a few key lessons and tools there that we can all utilize and go forth and create our own awesomeness. So without further ado, enjoy this episode of Happy Days. G'day, Sam.
How's it going, Jesse?
How you going, mate?
I'm good. I'm on holidays in Port Macquarie.
Magnificent.
Yeah, it's good.
That's great. Thanks so much for being on this Happy Days podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, man. We'll get right into it. I've got this weird echo going on, so I'm hearing my voice.
I don't know. I don't think I can do anything about that. Can I?
No. That's okay. It's just one of those things, technical gremlins. So all good. So Sam,
author,
drummer.
Yes.
Man of leisure. How do you do all this, mate?
I got into drumming I played trombone in big bands in school.
Wow.
Yeah, so I was classically trained on brass instruments like euphonium and trombone and stuff. And I did that through school and a little bit at uni, but it sort of faded away because I wanted to get into drumming. And drumming started as a passion of mine, and I had to teach myself just tapping on my knees and, constantly getting told to stop. My parents didn't want to have anything to do with it. They were like, oh, you can't have a drum kit. Play, it's too loud. Here's a trombone, which I thought was very odd.
Yeah, it's crazy.
When I was playing in big bands and jazz bands and concert bands for school functions and university functions and things like that, I would jump on the drum kit when people were out of the room, basically, like when the drummer, you know, went to lunch and then they'd come back and they'd get angry at me. So I never had a drum kit to practice on, and I just had to try and self-teach myself by listening to music and tapping my feet and tapping my hands on just on the couch, you know, like just tapping on whatever I could. And I eventually got into some rock bands and did some cover bands and played on my first drum kit. I only got my first own drum kit when I was 21, and I'd already recorded an album or two then. Because, you know, I just didn't have the money, and I finally got this secondhand drum kit for $210. And I still use the basic shells for that now. It's quite remarkable that drum kit has seen me through hell and high water. It's a Pearl Export. I got a good deal on it, but...
And we're back.
Okay, good. Yeah, so I was saying that I've used the same drum kit I've got a good deal on a kit, and just have replaced pieces off it. But you know, the essential bass drum and toms are all the same ones that I got for $210 when I was 21 years old. And I got a double kick for my 21st birthday off friends. And I had never played double kick before, and I always wanted to. And within 3 months, I recorded a full album with a band called Requiem of the Damned in Newcastle with double kicks, just, I don't know, just pretending like I learned how to do it as I did the recording for 3 weeks, I suppose.
Yeah.
And then it was just onwards from there. I did Requiem of the Damned for a few years. I sang, did vocals for Eternatus in Brisbane.
Nice.
For a few years, and we did a really good EP and did a good album with Requiem. And I was playing in an indie rock band as well called The Juice Debacle, and I did a record with them. And from there, I just, you know, just was knocking around Brisbane and playing in bands when I could. And I don't know what I ended up having. I ended up in Decryptus eventually by just sort of everything fell to pieces.
Mm.
And I got kicked out of or left all my bands, and I just sort of went and moved down to northern New South Wales for a few years, and I would just work on my drumming alone. Basically, I'd get really stoned and just play drums in my garage, and that enabled me to play a lot of new stuff that I never played. And that sort of combined with the experience I had with the other bands, like especially the band I played with, I lived on campus at the uni, University of Queensland, and I lived in a college there, and I played in like a covers band there, and that meant that I played like every genre all the time, had to learn songs at short notice, play parties, you know, and like that gave me a lot of versatility, and I think that versatility meant that I was able to play a lot of different things. And when it came full round to getting into playing metal, that sort of combined with the jazz band stuff that I'd done with trombone, and I found that I played drums thought I could, and you know, I'd expand my horizons, and I was doing a lot of new stuff, you know, with time signatures and things and jazz and swing feels that sort of came about from that background, combined with just sort of mucking around in the garage while high and just did stuff. And and then the opportunity came along to play in Decryptus, and I joined Decryptus and did a number of records with them and years of touring and fun with them. And we're presently on hiatus, and because of COVID, you know, people started in the band, started businesses, and I started writing books more. And from there, I joined Chaosphere. So now I'm presently, that's probably my main band, is drumming for Chaosphere. On the Gold Coast.
Nice, man.
That's cool.
With that mix of the trombone and drumming from jazz to metal. Do you agree there's a lot of truth in the theory that if you can play jazz, you can play almost anything?
I think that jazz is one of the top genres for technicality. You know, because in jazz, you know, if you play rock or pop or punk, you know, it's not very common that you'll play anything other than 4-4 or even, you know, maybe 2-4, like, you know, just basic four beat beats, you know.
Yeah.
In jazz, you play 5-4, you play 7-8, you play 6-8. And those time signatures, you know, they carry over to tech metal.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that jazz enables you to have such a wide toolkit. It doesn't have everything in it, obviously, because, you know, but there are definitely jazz things. I was talking about jazz. What was the last thing you heard, do you think?
Yeah, you were talking about your theory of how jazz, playing jazz relates to the transition to playing music and more importantly, so metal in your case.
Yeah, I think because of the different time signatures.
Yeah.
You know, like I definitely have played in bands that are metal bands that use 7-8 and used 6-8 a lot. You know, Decryptus used a lot of 6-8 and I had to expand if I used 6-8 a lot. And 5-4, you know, these things are unusual to play when you're playing a rock band. But if you play a metal, you know, it's good to have them there because I think a metal, you know, some people want to listen to more simplistic metal, but I think metalheads in general, they're a bit more open to like, oh, that's interesting. Oh, that's challenging where I think I should tap my foot or where I should bang my head. I'm more actively engaged in listening to metal. And that's what drew me to metal in the sense that I don't casually listen to music in the background. I generally listen to it as a focused activity. It tends to excite me and engage me completely. And I you know, I get sort of a bit worked up listening to music. So I don't just like music in the background that's easy. I want to work with it and like actively listen to it. So that's probably why I got into metal.
Yep.
As well as just the anger and the power, you know, like it's a great feeling to make people mosh and to make people move around and to let out a lot of that anger that they might feel.
I love that, man. That's the response to it all. And, you know, you mentioned playing, obviously, in two very, very well-loved metal bands in this country, for sure, Decryptus and Chaosphere. How do you enjoy that being the drummer in those bands and compared to, you know, where you've said you've come from playing in covers bands and playing in rock bands and such?
I think they all have their advantages. I mean, it's not like playing in a covers band doesn't have lots of fun. And if you're living on campus and you're playing in the band at all the parties and stuff, that definitely has a level of fun. But you're playing other people's music, and after, you know, so many years of playing Foo Fighters covers and Killers covers and things that we were playing in the mid-noughties that were, party anthems and stuff, it was definitely nice to move on to something that I could call my own.
Yeah.
Or make my own. And I think, that started with metal because with Requiem, of the Damned, there was definitely, they had an established sound. I heard it and I was like, I want to play goth metal band. I'd never even heard goth metal before. And they're like, hey, go check Catatonia. And I was like, whoa, this is amazing. And I want to play in a band that's like that, you know, that's like Typo Negative, that's like Joy Division, something that's got those sort of things in it, the more morose themes and stuff. And I did that and it was very expansive. And when I sang in Eternus, I was the vocalist. That gave me my first taste of when a band becomes quite popular at a city level.
Yeah.
And the, you know, like when you're playing shows and you're headlining Brisbane shows, and there's a Brisbane band, and you're seeing the same people at shows, and it gives you a very, very minor level of celebrity. I remember the first time that someone came up to me in a public place. You know, that wasn't a show we were playing. And I was like, hey, are you the singer of Eternatus? I was like, yeah. And she was like, you fucking suck.
Wow.
And I was like, I really feel like I made it.
What was the last thing you heard me say?
So we're talking about your metal journey and more importantly, your first your public first experience where you're asked about being in a band.
After that, did we?
pretty much. And you got told that you sucked.
Yeah. Positions well into Decryptus because it. I mean, it was only sometime this year, and Decryptus hasn't played a show.
Of
COVID, and then you know everyone was out of COVID, and then it was hard to put. You know, the smoke had cleared. I went out of van and just went Decryptus. You know.
Like, I've already given the horse, and be like, yeah, yeah, mate, yeah.
Good one. Crazy, man. And like, being in the from that band environment,
yeah,
like, being in the
sorry,
that band environment,
yeah, yeah, sorry, sorry. Coming from that band environment, yeah, yeah. Sorry, and
being,
going
coming from that band environment,
whole,
and going through, well,
yeah, the obviously madness of the,
last 2 years.
How do you then make that transition? Into being a writer.
I was all writing when I was younger, and sort of major thing that I tried writing for year 11 assignment, like a first chapter of a novel. And the teacher was encouraging and said, "Hey, you should write a novel." So I wrote, you know, a decent amount of it. As a teenager, and then when I went to uni, when for holidays, I'd write a bit more and write a bit more.
Yeah. So
in a way, at it, but life, you know, like it got in the way. I was mainly doing bands, and so that sort of went by the wayside. And ironically, even though I've written plenty of other things in the meantime, it's only this year that
I finally, after 20 years, finished writing that novel that I started when I was. When I was 16, and I've sent it to a major publisher for consideration because that's a baby of mine that I really want to take a big leap forward with, because I spent a lot of time editing it and rewriting and writing and writing, and it's this big magnum opus about like it's a science fiction epic, and I don't want to go into what it's about because it's going to be a big surprise for the future, but it was a hobby. Writing was a hobby that I did around uni.
Mm.
And around my life and around being in bands. And it often got neglected because I was so focused on drumming for years. And, you know, I played in half a dozen bands and probably did about 8 or 10 records. And so I was busy with that. And that was what I thought my life was for. When COVID happened, I'd already been getting published more by that point. Like I'd already, around 2016, a friend of mine came to me and said, "Hey, I know this guy. He does. He's got a small independent publishers, you know, an indie press, and he's doing anthologies of short stories. And if you write a short story, you can be in the short story anthology." And so I wrote some stories about some of the more common anecdotes I tell people. I have a UFO experience that I had, where me and my friends saw a UFO shaped like a yin yang.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that's an interesting anecdote, but it's a long one. So, but that's what it boils down to. And I had a fire breathing accident where I was badly hurt doing fire breathing. And so I wrote both of those into a short story, and they went into anthologies. And from there, it was kind of like the way that playing in the covers band in college was good for my drumming, because I had to write. I had to play lots of genres. I started getting in more and more anthologies by different people that were running them, different small presses. And it was like, "Hey, can you write a horror story? Can you write a ghost story? Can you write a romance story? Can you write this?" And I just practiced, you know, like writing short stories and getting them published. And I think I might have like nearly 150 short stories published now. And 70 of those are in my own debut collection, which came out in 2020, which is called Infinity and I, 70 sci-fi short stories. And that was a big jumping forward for me, because that was when my first own book came out. But me and my friend that first introduced me to the anthologies is like, we could do this. And we started our own small publishers called Zombie Pirate Publishing. And we did that for 5 years. And that was really good. You know, like we kept busy and we did about 20 books. And we published hundreds of books by hundreds of authors, hundreds of stories in short story collections, you know, and had all sorts of themes, you know, whether they were science fiction or fantasy, you know, steampunk and all sorts of genres. And from there, I decided that I, you know, needed to grow by writing my own novels. And that's kind of the phase that I'm in now where I, you know, I fixed up that old novel that I'd been working on for a long time, got together some other things that I'd half finished and started some new projects. And in more recent years, I've published a number of novellas and short novels. And presently I'm publishing two different series with Raventail Publishing, which is a horror imprint of a bigger publisher from the States called Dusty Saddle Publishing, which does westerns, but they branched out and they started a new horror imprint. And I just kind of was in the right place at the right time because they just kind of launched and they said, hey, we're launching, we need material. And I just kind of showed up like Homer Simpson on the first day that the plant opened and said, hey, I'm around. And so they snapped up my series that I was writing at the time, which called The Dead Sun Chronicles.
Yep.
And that's cosmic horror set out in like a journey in space and demons whispering from the warp and the crew going insane sort of thing. And the more recent thing I've been working on is called Depths of Horror, which is about futuristic submarines battling against a underwater creature. So that's the present sort of projects that I'm working on.
That's amazing, man. Amazing, congratulations. Man.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like with being published,
how is that experience
as a writer
and author
today to share with people out there listening?
I think that people definitely don't have a clue how hard it is and even the nature of what the difficulties. Like you know, you publish your Freaks comics and and your the Warriors themed books, and it's a struggle. And you know, while we live in a great time because there's so much access, like it's like anything, the internet has grown to such proportions and has invaded our everyday existence into like smartphones into our pockets. You know, everyone's checking the internet dozens of times a day to the point where we're addicted to our smartphones. So the level of access is humongous. The complexity of the internet has become massive. And yet people's ability to find individual authors that they might not have been shoved down their throat by some mass media thing has become difficult because it, you know how the comparison of George Orwell's 1984 to Brave New World by Aldous Huxley?
I haven't read them, but
yeah. You should read them. They're fun, quote unquote, fun books. But in George Orwell's vision of a dystopian future, there's people who are actively destroying information. So it's hard to find things because there's people rewriting history and there's people destroying history. In Brave New World, there's so much information that no one can find the truth because it's a needle in the haystack. So in both visions, people are unable to access the truth, one because the truth is destroyed and one because the truth is hidden in so much white static, white noise. And I think that that's the kind of a good analogy for how it is to be any given one creator. So as a whole, there's a lot of art out there. People can read endless free books. You know, there's people giving away material, people giving away music, people giving away visual art every day. And because there's so much being given away, people think that A, it should be continuously free and that they have no obligation to the artist to recompense them. And they, that how do they discover any given person when there is so much out there? And so we, Amazon has given us the ability to be published more and more and more. And I wouldn't have been able to start a small publisher with my friend unless there was Amazon there as an existing framework and their print on demand. That's, you know, because we couldn't afford to buy a printing press. We couldn't afford to buy, you know, 2,000 copies of a book in a garage. Amazon provided a framework that enabled us to continue to function. And but on the flip side, it's, you know, it's a behemoth that's taken over the world and now we don't have any other option. And unless you can do well on the algorithm and know how to really game the all of the Amazon ads and the Facebook ads and, you know, wheeling and dealing in the language of the algorithm, unless you know how to game all that stuff. And I have a real problem with the fact that success now comes from gaming the algorithm rather than writing quality books. Because they've done studies about music. Sorry to jump back and forth, but it's almost like the music and the writing are two analogies for each other.
The parallels are incredible.
They did studies that showed that music has become more like each other. It's the range of music has become narrower over time. They, you know, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, people were very creative. They wrote a bigger range of, they used more notes. There was more notes. And if you graph the use of notes and you graph the use of number of words, so even the amount of words that people are saying in the songs, over time, they're narrowing in on a shorter, smaller range. So that now songs, as an average, if you take all, like, you know, songs that are out there, people are using less notes on average and people are using less words to describe their songs in lyrics. And so I think that what is happening in writing now is because some behavior is being rewarded and some behavior is being punished almost by being ignored by the algorithm, people are learning what pleases Amazon. And as it also is what pleases the reading audience, but Amazon is the gatekeeper. And unless Amazon shows your stuff to people, they have a much harder time finding it unless they're actively going and just trawling through things and finding what they consider to be their personal preference of whatever. You know, you're mainly having something sort of pushed in front of you and
by getting really good at
learning how to push their stuff just in front of you. And that means that they're writing books and also producing covers for books that are the same. To the point where if you want to produce a science fiction book now, you're much, much, much better off designing the cover to fit a certain set of parameters so that it looks a certain way as a thumbnail for Amazon than if you just gave an artist and said, I want you to design some things. You know, you're a visual artist. You know, I want to be creative. I want to say what I want to say. Instead, we just got a spaceship flying through space with a nice big bold font, some space in the background, some nice bright colors. And so people know that it's sci-fi. So they know to click it. That's, you know, otherwise why will they find it? But all that stuff is it's not negative, but it is it's focusing on the fact that there's problems. And I like to focus on the positives. I like to focus on the positives.
We
do have a platform that people can read my books. I'm very pleased that there are people out there, anyone who reads any of my books. I've been giving away free review copies recently and asking people to review it of Depths of Horror. And I'm very pleased that people have been taking them and saying, yes, I'll give you a review in exchange for a fair review in exchange for this ebook. Thank you very much. And I'm just happy they're reading it. If they review it, you know, I'll be happy. But I'm just happy. And I think that makes me a bit of a sucker in this day and age, is the sense that I only got into drumming, I only got into writing to perform for people, because I think ultimately I'm an entertainer. You know, I like juggling. I did fire twirling. I did fire breathing.
So you were talking about all the many hats you wear, like juggling and fire breathing and fire twirling, and then talking about, you know, just that incredible creative balance that you seem to hold, that's taking you into this writing journey that you're on. I find it incredibly inspiring, and plus your views on how you approach publishing and the many battles with the internet that come with it. So, yeah, definitely got my thumbs up, man.
Why don't you ask me another question so to let me bounce off that?
Yeah, absolutely, man. Well, I guess what I wanted to know is, because you've written such a diverse range of, you know, horror and sci-fi, and fantasy and that, like, what's your preferred style of writing? Do you prefer horror, or are you more inclined to go sci-fi?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'm going to give a very oblique answer to it. Because I had the UFO experience, I had a really strange spiritual awakening after that, and I probably went a bit crazy in the sense that I went and started researching UFOs and then all sorts of things, and then I got into occultism. And it's not that I'm, you know, doing rituals and stuff, and, you know, I wouldn't consider that I take it too seriously to the point where, you know, it's running my life or anything, but I definitely established a worldview in which I was curious about the nature of reality and the nature of my own experience in it and what happens after death and, you know, how much free will we have, and classic sort of philosophy questions, but approached from this angle that I thought that I was, you know, that I still think that I'm seeing it through, which is sort of like occultism being what is hidden. You know, that's what I define occultism as, you know, the layer of reality beyond what we call the full reality, you know, that the scaffolding behind the play, you know, like if we're looking at a play, there's things backstage that are informing what we're looking at, and that our whole reality is a symbolic representation. And in that way, our reality itself is a work of art. That in the same way as you're looking at a painting, and it might be an abstract painting, like, what do these symbols mean? You know, they've got a triangle there, a big eye over here, a bunch of snakes. What do all these symbols mean? You know, I think that reality is speaking to us in the language of symbols to interpret. And at that point, I realized that art was the most important thing that I could do personally. I had trained in other fields at university. I tried to work in those jobs. And I've worked in other jobs, and I just felt that none of.
I said the best part of my answer got cut off because I was saying that reality itself is like a painting that you're observing, and that in the same way as you might look at an abstract painting and the symbolic representations of feelings or thoughts, I think reality itself is speaking to us in that way, and that's interpret. Occultism more than doing rituals, I tap into it in the way that reality is like the main tenet of life is to pay attention and to see how it's speaking to you, in the same way as maybe shamanism spoke of a type of animism, that the trees are speaking to you, that the animals are speaking to you, the sky is speaking to you. If you see an eagle, that means something. And I think that that's when I realized that art was the most important thing that I could do with my life, because I'd worked in other jobs, I'd trained in other things at university, and yet I didn't think that I could excel in those fields. I couldn't bring a unique type of thinking to them. But in art, I thought there was something that I could bring to, because I could learn this symbolic language of art and this symbolic language of feelings and thoughts and abstract things and create fantastical things. And that's why I write sci-fi, fantasy, and horror mainly, because it's not set in what people's idea of real is. It's stretching people's idea of what is possible, what shapes, dimensions, people, thoughts, aliens, demons, you know, what different colors that couldn't exist, things that aren't real but could be real if we could just bring them into our imagination. The same way as people are inventing technologies all the time, they had a thought, they did something, and now it's something that we use all the time. There was a time when that wasn't real, when that wasn't in our vocabulary, when it wasn't in our experience. I think sci-fi stretches. I think horror even stretches, and fantasy stretches. You know, and if you get beyond, there's a lot of tropes, obviously, archetypes and things that people use, and you need to use them. They're like tools. You know, you pick up and use like a palette of colors and things, but you need to put them together in new ways and relate them to the fantastical. I think more than most, nothing against any other writers, I just do my own thing. I think that, you know, some of my books are definitely stretching reality as far as I can go, like to weird dimensions, because like, for example, in my book, The Beast from Beyond, which is the book one of the Dead Sun Chronicles, that's a sci-fi horror book. And in it, the main character, you can't tell whether he's going crazy, whether he's been poisoned by these strange engines that, that power the ship, or whether, you know, there's a demon whispering from another dimension, but constantly his reality will bend and he will take him, you know, just looking at something as simple as looking at a ceiling fan will send him into a swirling vortex and he'll go into another realm. And I think that people, you know, they expect their stories to be easy, that it's expected that everything makes sense. And I'm not saying I'm trying to confuse people, but I am trying to challenge them by seeing how the things around them might mean beyond just looking at a fan, just looking at an animal or looking at a shape or looking at a color or having an experience, and that there could be different levels, and that, you know, by diving through the conscious level, we can find the subconscious level of what is down beneath what we think we're experiencing. And there we might find more of what it is to be truly human, to have real feelings that step beyond our automatic responses. You know, like this, so our society is built upon so many automatic responses. You know, there's a sexy woman on an ad. Oh, I want to go buy that product. You know, like, oh, this guy's successful in a suit. I want to buy that watch. I want to be like him. You know, we're being pulled by strings left, right, and center. And I think that it's worth trying to cut the strings. It's worth trying to move beyond the strings and see if you challenge them where you can get and where you can take someone's mind. Because the people that I respect most in my life are the people that put an idea in my head that things aren't what they seem. And that's difficult to do. And it doesn't really get you a lot of rewards or thanks, but it's worth doing, because at least it's not just being and there's nothing wrong with being a regular. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Sorry. There's nothing wrong with being a regular person and doing a regular job. I think every life is important, and everyone is on their own journey and has got a beautiful life. But I think there's definitely, it's interesting to follow the people who are saying, I'm going to go off the grid. I'm going to go out of here with a new idea, see where it can take us. And you never know. It might open up a new way of being that has that saves someone's life. You know, it can be that traumatic, because it can change someone's entire perspective. And I've seen how things have intervened in my life, you know, like the fire-breathing accident I had that caused me to rethink. You know, I thought I was going to die. You know, I was very hurt. I was like, what am I at uni for? Why am I doing this particular subject? Do I really want to do it? And then when I saw the UFO, I was like, am I on the right path? You know, I didn't realize, that there could be other dimensions to life. You know, there could be life beyond life and things to discover. I think that it's a beautiful thing to do, and also a terrible thing to do, because it smashes people's illusions, which can be very traumatic. And I know that, you know, it was difficult for me to have the things that I held dear, constructs that I thought gave me a normal life that stepped on a normal path. But I realized I was a weirdo, you know, and it was okay. And it's been a good journey for me, where I think writing ultimately and writing weird let me realize that it's okay to be not like everyone else.
And that there are other people out there who don't want the same thing everyone else wants.
I love that. That's a really good way of looking at things.
I think more people need to be aware that it's okay to be a little bit different and think a little bit differently to the norm. So kudos.
I think there was an interesting thing, you know, where I think I'm not saying I'm schizophrenic, but I definitely have a mind that leans towards the schizophrenic stuff and like sees things that aren't real and sees things that I, you know, and I've almost turned what is essentially could be a mental illness and you know, like that has its dark side, definitely, you know, terrible anxiety, definitely self-doubt. I suffer from OCD. You know, I definitely have my demons that I battle against. But on the flip side of that, it's almost like because my mind works differently, whether I'm neurodivergent as a clinical definition or whether I'm just very, you know, creative and sensitive. But whatever it is, I've seen to of other dimension. And you come back as a messenger and you say, hey, I've seen some stuff. I want to now practice a craft. And that's the crazy bit is you can come back and you can have a message. You can say, oh man, I saw some stuff. But if you can't express it, you know, people don't get anything out of it. So I think being an artist isn't just about having weird experiences and then wanting to tell people about it. It's about putting in the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours to work on your craft so that when you have a thought and you have a strange thought, that you can actually verbalize it, you can articulate it. And it takes a lot of practice. And I don't think people, you know, to come around, you said like what people don't know what it takes to publish, or people want some insight into how to, you know, what is behind publishing. And the answer is a lot of time spent alone thinking and practicing and trying. And people, I don't think, understand how many hundreds of hours, you know, they say it takes 10,000 hours to master something.
Mm.
And it's very true. You know, same with drumming. It took many, many, many hundreds of hours in order to get good so that when you had an idea, you could actually physically, you know, I always have like sort of this metaphor of like, you know, with the painter, they can see something in their mind, and unless their hand can make the movements that describe that vision, they can't get it out.
So they need
to practice with their hand so that their hand becomes a tool that's connected directly to their mind, like there's a wire between the two. So when they see something, their hand moves in exactly that fashion. And being a writer is the same with that. And I'm okay with all of the failures I've had and all of the journey of, oh, that book wasn't a success and everyone ignored that book, or I wrote that book and I put it in a drawer and no one will ever read that, or I put this out and I tried my best but only 10 people read it. You know, I think all of that is moving me through the stages of an invisible curriculum. And that's another, ties in with another thing with how I view reality and occultism being a way of life, is that you do have spiritual teachers who are guiding you step by step through every part of your life. You learn something, that's them taking you through that piece of coursework. And if it's a failure, even more so, because if you just blindly succeed and everything you touch just turns to gold, what lesson is there in that? You need to learn to fall down so that you can step back up. And if you do that, and if you keep getting back up and you keep getting back up in here, what you will eventually achieve is self-autonomy and a beautiful creation of your own life, your own life being a work of art where you can say, I'm proud of what I've become. I've worked through my faults, my prejudices, everything that was holding me back. And in the process, I've been making this beautiful art, and you'll find you'll make some piece of art late in life that you're like, that expressed exactly what I went through. And some other human, some other time in history, will read that or look at that piece of art and they will feel not alone. They will read your work and they'll say, this person makes me feel like, even though I'm strange, even though I'm different, even though I'm going through an experience that's difficult, here is someone else who was there, who survived, they got through it, and here they are expressing something I might make it to.
I love it.
I love it. Man.
That's really good.
Outlook on how you approach things
and how others should really take it on board and follow that path.
That's amazing.
Yeah, great.
I won't hold you up too much longer.
I think you've given some amazing insight and advice. And I guess I have one more question for you.
Just in regards to budding writers out there wanting to get their work published.
Besides practicing their craft, What piece of advice would you offer?
I think there's definitely practicing your craft in terms of writing your books, but then there's practicing your craft in terms of the other art form, which is how the hell do I get this into the world? Mm. You know, and I can't say that I'm a master of that. I definitely have had more success than someone with no success. You know, I have books published, I have series published, I've got more coming. And so that, you know, it was just trial and error, really. I think that the best thing you can do is get out and meet people. I think you make your own opportunities. You make your own luck by meeting people. You know, like I've met you by interacting with you and your artwork.
Yes.
You know, we've become friends and mutually respected professionals because it's been a give and take of, hello, I'm going to share your stuff. I'm going to say to people, this is worth looking at. Please check it out. You know, I think that you can network. I think you can start asking people for opportunities. Try to get your work published. It's not as hard as you think. I think that if someone is like, I want to write, write something and send it somewhere. Send it to an online journal. Send it to an online magazine. Send it, you know, search for anthology submissions. And just start not only practicing your writing, but practicing sending things out so that you're constantly getting a feedback loop of, oh, people are aware. You know what it's like being in a band, you know, like you'll get more gigs if you go to gigs, absolutely, if you talk to people, you know.
Yep.
won't meet promoters and other bands and people who can give you a shot unless you show up. And where do you show up now? Well, it's on the internet, you know, like it makes me a bit sad because I feel like, you know, I wish you could still walk out your door and have a sense of community because it's a double-edged sword, you know, because you meet people online and, you know, you have a friendship, but sometimes when you're alone in your house and you're sitting there going, oh, my friends are in America and they're all in Europe and I never get to see them. I only talk to them online and I've never even heard their voice maybe, you know. It can be very disconcerting and disconnecting, even though it's very connecting. So I would say that the main advice would be try to put yourself out there, but also grow a thick skin in that you can't expect it to be the way that you think it will go. Just allow the journey to happen and just keep trying.
That's a brilliant piece of advice. I really like that. And Sam, I just want to say... It's wonderful seeing what you've created and what you continue to create. And I wish you nothing but the best of luck and success.
You too, mate. I really appreciate having the conversation and feel like, you know, my voice is heard. It's great that you're giving people a chance to speak about their lives. I really appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely, mate. We'll have a link to your work in the description box of this episode.
Great. I'll send you all of that.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Sam. You take care of yourself and enjoy a holiday.
Yep. You too, mate. Cheers very much.
Cheers. See ya.
See ya.
Bye.
And that was my awesome Happy Days chat with Sam Phillips. A huge thanks to Sam for taking time out of his holidays to have this chat. And again, deepest of apologies to everyone trying to listen to this episode that's had to endure these weird technical glitches, including my echo voice. I don't know how the hell that happened, but it happened. So, as I said, you know, in the world of podcasting, especially at my level, it really is a roll of the dice. But we got through it. And I thought it was a great episode. Sam is a great guy, and we'll definitely chat to him again in the near future. But thanks for tuning in, everyone. If you enjoyed this episode, leave it a like. Go that one for one little step further and leave a review of the Happy Days podcast. And also subscribe to the channel if you haven't done so already on whatever streaming platform you listen to your podcasts on, whether it's iTunes, whether it's Anchor, whatever, man. Just show some love so that others can find me. Till then, have yourselves a happy week. Have yourselves a great week. And as always, you've been awesome. I've been Jesse. Till next time, stay happy. Stay happy. Stay happy. Keep positive. And have yourselves a happy week. Peace out.